You are listening to the sexy episode of the Pug News Podcast, episode number 318, the sexiest of all numbers. Back to the Pug News Podcast. This is Features Editor John Gentile, and as Managing Editor, Adam White just told me, he turned down the lights in his house to increase the mood and the sexiness. Adam White, are you feeling extraordinarily sexy this evening?
Well, the sexy thing about number 318, John, as a number, is that both the 3 and the 8 could look like butts.
That's right. Yeah, one's I guess the frontal view, and one's the top view.
Butts all around, right? And as we all know, that is really the height of romance is how many butts. So,
you know, isn't it weird that like human beings are attracted to butts? I mean, myself included. But like butts are actually like pretty nasty. Like they're like, well, actually, that's a question. Are butts nasty because they are the humanity's disposal device, or you know, waste processing device, or is it just a part of humanity and part of the miraculousness of the beauty of the human system?
Ricky, you're a millennial. What do you think about butts?
Yeah, Ricky, where do you stand on butts?
I feel like I need an adult. This got weird real fast. Butts, they're, you know what? They're there, and we deal with them, and that's it. Don't ask questions, guys.
Butts, they're there, and we deal with them. That is advice for the ages.
Stop asking questions.
Oh, God, John, this intro went way off the rails. I'm Adam White. I'm recording in Niagara Falls. This is Ricky in Los Angeles. Yeah.
No.
Well, there we go. This is Features Editor John Gentile. We got a super busy week this week. Big news week. Big news week. We're going to get right into the songs, then we're going to get right into the news. I'm going to play a song off Kicker's new album, in case you don't know. Kicker is an awesome, 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 I guess you would call them a punk supergroup. Out of Oakland, out of San Francisco, out of the Bay Area. It's got Pete the Roadie on vocals. Pete's roadied for Amoebix, Subhumans, the A-Heads, Fugazi, Jello Biafra. He is a character. He's been roadieing since 1978. He's from England. He lives in the United States now. And he is one of the most genuine lovers of punk rock I've ever met. There's a lot of jadedness in punk rock, a lot of people that, you know, like are too cool for this, too cool for that. Pete has been doing the punk rock thing for 40 years, and he is still one of the most genuinely enthusiastic guys about punk rock. He's a character. Kicker is his first band. On guitar, you have Mouths of Dystopia, the Crust Legends Dystopia. On bass, you have Dave Ed of Neurosis. And on drums, you used to have Toby. He's no longer in the band, but he's on this recording. He left the band, because he had he's a grown guy with grown-ass responsibilities. And so anyway, Toby on drums. Toby used to be in Submachine. They've got a new album out on Tank Crimes. It's their second album. It's called Rendered Obsolete. And this is, I think, the first single off the album. The album's awesome. You should check it out on Tank Crimes. The single is called You Can't Take Me Anywhere. We'll be right back. And that was Kicker doing You Can't Take Me Anywhere. Let's get right into the news, boys. A lot of news this week, a lot of news. And let me tell you, the news this week kicks off with a little bit of personal story of mine. I saw Morrissey this past week. And before I even get on to that, the night after I saw Morrissey, he played Brooklyn. And for his encore in Brooklyn, Morrissey covered the Ramones, Judy Is a Punk. And it was quite fitting because before Morrissey came out and before he comes out for all his shows, there's a montage of videos. And they play the New York Dolls. They play the Sex Pistols. They play Patti Smith. They play Lou Reed. They play the Ramones. And it's kind of, these are the things that make Morrissey Morrissey. And it was kind of cool. It's kind of like Morrissey saying, these are the things that make me me. Although there was one interesting thing is, all the videos were from like 1976 to 1982, kind of like that classic first wave punk era, maybe a little bit before, except there was this one video, and if someone knows what this video is, please let me know. Like, you know, it's going like Ramones, Sex Pistols, New York Dolls, Lou Reed, and then all of a sudden there's this video. It looks like it's from past 2 or 3 years. It's four suburban kids, four skinny suburban kids. They look like they're about 16, three white kids and one black kid, and they're rapping like this hardcore gangster cut. And I'm like, are these guys rapping? But then it seemed like they were lip syncing to another artist, but I wasn't sure what it was. So if anybody has any background on what that track was, I'd love to know. I couldn't figure out what it was. I found it to be extremely interesting because Morrissey's doing all these like classic era new wave things or classic era of punk things, and then all of a sudden he breaks out this gangster cut, which I'm like what it, like, but it's not even like a gangster cut because it's like these 16-year-old suburban kids like rapping to this gangster cut. I had no idea what it was. It was weird but interesting, and as Morrissey is wont to do, he's always throwing a curveball. But and I'm going to talk about my Morrissey experience in a minute. But in Brooklyn, he did not do this in Philadelphia. In Brooklyn, he covered the Ramones' Judy's a Punk, Adam White. Oh, actually, and there's a little bit of background on Morrissey. Morrissey, before he was Morrissey, he famously probably posted the first article in press in England that talked about how horrible the Ramones were. Like it's a famous article where Morrissey just talked about how shitty the Ramones are and how they're not as good as the New York Dolls. But eventually he would come around and actually even curate a Ramones collection. Adam White, did you enjoy this or was this just empty pandering?
I enjoy this. Actually, as a as far as a fan shot video of a live concert goes, you could do a lot worse than this. It's actually watchable, which is surprising. So if you usually shy away from that kind of, footage of live acts that someone has captured on their like iPhone 4 or whatever, this is much better than you would, I think, normally get. I don't know why it is. It may have just been the vantage point, but it doesn't sound horrible. So totally listenable. He also plays Irish Blood, English Heart, which is actually a Moz song that I know on this video, which is kind of cool. And then he gets naked, which fits into the theme of tonight's super sexy punk news podcast. And since you have just since you experienced the show, and assuming that the show that you were at, you weren't running out the doors to get in your car before the crowd leaves, before the encore. Do people do that?
Dads do. Dads famously say,
it always drives me crazy because, like, if I go see a Sabres game in Buffalo, there's definitely that point where, like, everything's gone to shit and everyone just starts to leave before the game is done. And I can never bring myself to do that. I don't know. Like, it just feels weird. Like, you get to this point where, and let's face it, we're talking about the Sabres here. So we're just like, all hope has lost and it's just failures to compound upon failure. And, nothing's going to turn around. And you're just like, you know what? Fuck it. I'm leaving. And I can just never do it. I feel like I'm wasting my money doing that. Well, but I don't know if people do that at like concerts.
Some people do. A lot of people, like at huge concerts, a lot of people will leave before the encore because they're worried about park. Like Rolling Stones, I love the Rolling Stones. Tickets are not cheap for the Rolling Stones. Still, dads are famous saying, we gotta be traffic. It's like, you paid $150 to be here. Are you really going to do that just to avoid a half hour of traffic and you miss like the encore? So at jumbo concerts, people do. Not at Morrissey, and we'll get into that in a minute because Adam White.
But anyway, so John, if you stayed and didn't go back to your car like a dad,
I did
for the encore, did he also get naked on your show?
He did. I think that's the thing on this tour. And he was wearing a different colored shirt. And I was thinking, is where are all these shirts coming from?
Yeah.
Do you think he requested them on his rider or something?
That's what I wanted to ask. Because on the one hand, if you're Morrissey, you got to be wearing a very specific shirt, right? Like, you can't have a shirt that's made of, like, of seal or anything. Like, it has to be an ethically sourced shirt. So these aren't just like, just random animal byproduct sweatshop shirts that he's wearing, because Morrissey has some standards, as we all know. So does he have like just like an extra suitcase full of like
shirts,
throw into the crowd shirts, and he just burns through one every day? Or is like the first half of his day in every city he gets into, he has to go source out like a cool ethically sourced stage shirt that he will then discard that very day? Like, I'm curious.
If his manager was smart, as part of his rider, his manager would say, you must buy a shirt from this store or this website and have it for us when we come to the show.
I just can't command that much power. I wish I could command, you know.
You know what's interesting, Adam? Maybe sometime after the podcast, watch this video again. I'm loath to admit it, but I was trawling through the Morrissey fan sites to like kind of get more information about the show. People are saying he's wearing JNCOs, and watching this video, it looks like he might be wearing JNCOs.
So if I was to, like, I don't know, request of, say, like, my in-laws that, like, Adam will bring the kids over for dinner, however, the stipulation is that I want a shirt, like a fancy new, you know, nice quality, good thread count, well-made, American-made, John. American,
exactly. Right?
An American-made shirt. You know, as really part of my bringing the kids over to grandma's rider, then. Anyways, but yeah, no, this was cool. I thought it was fun. Ricky, what do you think?
I thought this was kind of, you know, Morrissey doing a melodramatic, you know, I thought it was kind of boring, to be honest. I think he took all of the aggression out of the Ramones song. And, you know, I don't know why he has to, you know me and Morrissey, I've taken shots at Morrissey, and I don't need to do it for this one, but I thought it was a nice try. I think he should be covering not the Ramones. The shirt thing was odd, and just kind of adds to the evidence that this guy just thinks he's the shit. So,
but I'm glad you said that, Ricky, because, you know, people say, Ricky Frank, will Ricky stop talking about pears? People are like, will John stop talking about bad canoes? Let me tell you, people.
Adam
you
White think, and Dirty Nil.
Well, people Adam White, but people love when Adam White talks about Dirty Nil, because no one ever says anything bad about a Canadian. Anyways, people think that Ricky is in the pears or that I'm in the bad canoes. Let me tell you, people, we ain't got jack shit on Morrissey fans.
That's true. I mean, did you watch that Chris Gethard interview with John Lennon from like Reno 911? I think I mentioned John. Tom Lennon. I think that's his name. He was a lieutenant in Reno 911. And they just sit for 45 minutes obsessing about the Smiths and Morrissey.
That ain't nothing, Ricky. Yeah. That ain't nothing.
I watched the whole thing because the dedication just from those two was incredible.
Now, I'll give you guys a couple of examples. Sean Sinclair of Mischief Brew was there. Sean Sinclair is a very gentle guy, but he's a big guy and he's a tough guy. And he, by some different happenstance, he wound up to be four rows from the stage. And so after the show, I run into him. I'm like, oh man, Sean, did you enjoy the show? And he looked like he was like he was in a bad mood. I'm like, dude, what happened? And what happened was for the encore, the Morrissey fans bum rushed the show, and people were like stepping on him and like shoving him. One guy was like stepping on like the back of his leg to like fold his knees in. He ended up having to punch somebody because some guy was like climbing on top of him at Morrissey. Morrissey is literally commands the power that Bieber does over teens, I guess, if you will. Now, Adam White, give me some feedback here. I was talking to a young lady before the show started. She was there by herself. And she was a really big Morrissey fan. And my question is, I'd like to discuss how into Morrissey she was, but I think it might come across as me making fun of her when she seemed like a nice person. So maybe we shouldn't, you know?
Or just preface saying you're not make fun of her.
Good. Exactly. Okay. I will just give you an example of Morrissey fan. I'm not making fun of this girl. She seemed very nice. I see this girl sitting there by herself. So I start talking to her. And she's like, is this the first time you've seen Morrissey? I'm like, yeah, it's the first time I've seen her. And then she goes, she starts talking for about 25 minutes. Does not stop talking for 25 minutes. She wrote an 800-page screenplay about Morrissey and Johnny Marr living in the UK, except for they're Hispanic, they're Latino, and they're going out with each other. And the 800-page screenplay is about the trials and tribulations of their relationship. She wrote another novel about Morrissey during his 90s period, I guess, and the stuff that he would get into. And let me tell you, these people are into Morrissey.
Are you sure she wasn't shitting you?
I don't, honestly, Adam, I don't think so. My bullshit detector's pretty good, but I mean, by the way, she was going on and on. Like, I could tell that, like, she wasn't, how do I put it? She seemed entirely earnest in what she was saying to me. So either she was great at deception or she really did that, and I believe she did that.
See, like, I couldn't do that about a band, any band. I couldn't write something like that. That first of all, I don't have the time for that. And also, like, I don't think I would. I that much dedication is just ridiculous. And well, it's somewhat admirable in a sense, but still, like, that's a lot of work.
It speaks to the weird status that Moz has as some sort of otherworldly demigod to some people, where like you could never write a Hispanic gay fan fiction about pears because at some point,
like, what, not so quick. Give me 2 months.
Like at some point you realize that like those guys are probably people that you would potentially either see or interact with in some way. And they would be like, hey man, that was pretty fucking weird. And you would have to contend with that. But yeah. Morrissey is never going to go to the person that is writing Hispanic gay Morrissey, Johnny Marr fan fiction, and to interact with them really at all. So that distance creates enough space where I guess that kind of devotion can grow and foster in a weird way. I don't know. I don't know if I necessarily condone that as a good use of anyone's time, but it's kind of admirable. I mean, it's at least as useful as like 3/4 of the things that I've ever done in my life. So I'll give him that.
Well, like I said, people, you ain't whatever you think you're a fan of, you ain't got nothing on the average Morrissey fan. But I do want to mention one thing. First of all, Morrissey came out. He did almost all political songs. He didn't do a whole lot of love jams. And his political songs are my favorite ones. First of all, he sounded so fantastic. He sounded so good. I was doing that thing where you watch the mouth very closely to make sure he's not lip syncing. Yeah, have you guys ever done that? You've been at a show like I did that with like No Doubt too. Like they sound so good. You're like, are they lip syncing? They sound so good. Have you guys ever done that at a concert or anything?
I can't say that I have, John.
I have a couple times. Like Gwen Stefani when I saw No Doubt in like 2011, I think it was. I'm like, holy shit, she sounds fantastic. And so you like watch really closely. I'm almost sure Morrissey wasn't lip syncing because like the way to catch them is if they do something that you wouldn't factor for in like a piped recording, like, you know, maybe they miss a word or they cough or they say something midway through the song. And you can tell. So I definitely think he sounded amazing. He really did. Some people were a little angry because he did mostly the political songs. I love his political songs. He sounded great. He did Bullfight or Dies, which is one of my favorite songs. About 2/3 of the way through, he did Meat is Murder. You guys know the song Meat is Murder?
Even I know Smith's that song. One. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, man, let me tell you. So first of all, it starts with like a 2-minute, instead of doing kind of like the, I guess, melodic thin version by the Smiths, they turned it into almost like a drone metal or goth song. It was super loud, super heavy, a lot of ambient noise, a lot of kind of weird dubbish effects. 2-minute intro, like all these like super, you know, far out, just music stuff. Morrissey starts singing Meat is Murder. While he's singing, behind him, there are explicit videos of slaughterhouses. I mean, one video had a cow like like getting like putting this contraption where it, like squeezes the side and basically pinches the head off so that like the head is torn from the body by the squeezing machine. It's another video where they're taking goats where they're flipping goats on their back and slitting open their stomachs. Another video where they're throwing baby chicks into crunching machines. Another video where they slit a pig's neck and he stumbles around and he falls over dead. And man, I didn't want to watch it, but I knew I should watch it. And it was difficult. I mean, it was brutal. It was one of the most moving and challenging experiences I've ever had at a show. You know, and he's singing Meet His Murder. And then when they get to the end of the song, instead of the ending of the song, they expand it for another 5 minutes, the instrumental part. And it's just like this heavy as hell, almost like Sleep or High on Fire, or just like heavy, not metal, but super heavy, like these sound effects. And it's just all these different animals getting killed, like brutally. And a lot of the audience didn't like it. I didn't like it, but it was important, and I felt it was a very daring artistic thing to do. And I'm glad I saw it. And this is the truth. After it was over, I was shooken. I was quite shooken. And actually, I couldn't even focus for like the next three or four songs. And the weird thing is, like right after that, he kind of like rewarded the audience for going through that, and he did like his biggest hit, Every Day Is Like Sunday. And a lot of the audience like. The audience was visibly shaken and upset by it. And then as soon as he did Every Day's Like Sunday, like everyone forgot about it. And I'm like crying. I'm like looking around. Like, did you guys just not see what just happened? Like it was brutal. And I'm sure there's a counter argument for some of those videos, but nevertheless, those videos were real videos. And I will say, Morrissey has given me a lot to think about, and he has given me pause. That's for sure on certain things that I do. I'll tell you that I was moved and shaken. I really was. It was intense.
I'm just gonna let that slide. Yeah. Just sit or hang. I don't know. I don't know what to add to that. That was your experience, man. It was
brutal.
Pretty crazy.
It was brutal. Like I'm watching it, and like these cows are getting their heads like pinched off by this machine. I'm like, holy shit. So anyways, it was intense, baby. And like I said before, it's given me a lot to think about. I'm not gonna do any radical changes in my lifestyle right now, but I have a lot to think about, and that's
why. You probably want to get rid of that cowhead pinch machine that you got in your garage though.
maybe I want to close my private slaughterhouse that I use for my own private consumption. But let me tell you, people, this is why Morrissey is a real artist, because he goes where few artists have the guts to go.
So story number two for this week, and a huge one, and I think an unexpected one given what we talked about just a week ago.
Was that just a week ago?
Was it just a week ago? Was it like 2 weeks? It was super recent.
Yeah.
So the folks over at Maximum Rock and Roll broke this story. So Gloss, what's the acronym stand for? Girls Living
Outside Society.
Outside. Shit. I was going to say Against, but that is an A.
That's
Girls
Glass.
Living Outside Society shit. Yeah.
Glass is a different band.
have decided to break up. So in their statement, they said, Gloss has decided to break up and move on with our lives. We remain close friends, but are at the point where we need to be honest about the toll this band is taking on the mental and physical health of some of us. We are not all high-functioning people, and operating at this level of visibility often feels like too much. So the band is going to be playing the Not Dead Yet Fest in Toronto this October, and then one final show somewhere in the Northwest, and then that is it. So Gloss, as we spoke about last week, made a huge amount of noise, really all over the place, one of the biggest punk stories this year, because they, I guess we'll put an asterisk beside saying publicly, but they publicly revealed that they turned down a $50,000 offer to sign to Epitaph Records, the big, huge punk label of, you know, Bad Religion, Offspring, Rancid, NoFX fame. So Gloss turns down this huge offer. They make a big public stand. Asterisk beside public again. If no one listened to the episode where we talked about that, there was a little bit of contention about whether this was public or not, because it was something that was posted on a private Instagram account, but, you know, it got out and they've talked about it since, so whatever. But in any case, made a big stand on the internet about the fact that they were going to not sign to Epitaph, and, you know, made a lot of a lot of talk about how they were going to try to go it on their own, and how they were going to, you know, have this big massive first record, and they were gonna, you know, try to break out of existing paradigms and this and that. And then 2 weeks later, they are broken up. So that is a really weird turn on this. I haven't yet fully decided where I'm standing on this, but I might come around to it in a minute or two. Ricky, you are a huge Lost fan. There's no reason to not be.
I was definitely a fan. Yeah.
And we shouldn't say was, because they haven't done anything to destroy your fandom with this announcement. But
not really, no.
But what do you think? I mean, outside of the general of maybe disappointment about a band you like breaking up, how do you read this in the light of what happened?
Well, okay, so, I mean, when I saw this, I was shocked. We were just talking about them getting offered to sign to Epitaph, and I'm like, oh, okay. So, well, first of all, I just on a personal note, I'm very glad I saw them when I did, because that was maybe a month and a half ago. So, at least I got to see them once. And I also got I got Sadie Switchblade, their lead singer, to sign their first EP. So I'm glad I got that I did all that before any of this happened. I was surprised. I mean, I know like they didn't tour a whole lot. But when I saw this, I read the whole Maximum Rock and Roll statement that they had, and I just honestly I didn't hear a whole lot of specifics about why. And I'm it's just too soon after the Epitaph offer to make me wonder what that had to do with the breakup, and if it did. It's a shame though. They and because I guess we won't be hearing that supposed full length that they were supposed to press 20,000 copies of on vinyl. But no, this sucks. They were a fun and really, they were like a really fun and interesting band that were doing it completely DIY in a time where everyone is signing to some sort of label, whether it be big or small, but, they were doing it all on their own. And, I don't know. This sucks. Because I mean, they were just interesting, and they put out some really really good hardcore. I don't know. What do you guys think? I'd be curious to hear what you guys think about whether the Epitaph offer had anything to do with this, and also I wonder what Epitaph is thinking now.
Well, I guess they're glad they didn't give him 50 grand, that's for sure.
Yeah, I guess.
What I was going to say is someone had a funny comment like on the Punk News, in the Punk News website. Like you imagine like the band like sitting in a circle or whatever, or they're like, it's like a press conference or whatever, and one of them's like, and yeah, and we turned down $50,000 from Epitaph. And the other one is like, wait, what? We did what?
I wonder if that was actually like, looking back now, I wonder if that was actually a group decision, and that's just speculation. I'm not saying that's fact or anything, but I think it's something worth asking.
Yeah. I was curious about the phrase, we're not all high-functioning people. I thought high-functioning person was usually used in regards to, like, developmental disabilities. Isn't that what that used for? Are they using it in that way? Or do they just mean they're not people that like to be in the public?
I don't think they like... I don't think they like being so...
I think they're alluding that there's famous. Yeah, they're alluding that there's members of the band that either have, you know, that have some mental health challenge. I mean, as really like one in five people do, I think they're alluding that like in particular in the band, there's someone that has, I don't know, let's say anxiety or something.
Yeah,
that
they don't
would,
like being in the public eye that much.
I guess the part about this, John, that's really giving me pause here is I could absolutely see, you know, the offer coming down the pipe from Epitaph to them being something that all of a sudden made this like way more real, that all of a sudden meant that like, you know, that you can't just do what you were doing. Now you actually have to make some tough life changing choices. I could see that causing, you know, a fair amount of friction, like in any band, you know, quote unquote, high functioning or not. But I wonder if this was an inevitable outcome regardless of the Epitaph deal. So what I'm getting at is that, does this make their statement somehow insincere that they had put out after the Epitaph deal? Because the one number outside of the money that came out in that Epitaph statement that a lot of people that I saw actually a lot of people like record industry people kind of jump on and question was they alluded that they were going to do this big you know, much heralded LP, their big first LP. And they were saying that they were going to do a self-pressing of 20,000 copies. And I saw a lot of label people on Twitter and Facebook and everything else, you know, kind of saying that that didn't pass the smell test, that was a little bit of a wacky number to throw out there.
It's a lot.
You know, pretty audacious that they would be able to move those type, you know, that kind of units, even with a label's help, and that they were just going to claim that they could do on their own was, you know, was a little bit fishy. And I saw people saying that at the time. So I wonder now, you know, that combined with how much they said, you know, what was the last statement? I'm just looking at their statement here. You know, we don't have to jump into their world. We can create a new one. Like there was a lot of, like, you know, rah, rah, let's bomb the music industry and, you know, make our own game stuff that was in that statement. So I guess the one thing that this gives me some doubt about is that, like, how much of that was the plan that then has been since been derailed, and how much of that was actually, like, something they intended to do? Like, did they know they were going to break up and they were just blustering? I hope not, but that's what it kind of looked. That's what I'm reading.
Is this kind of the, like, kind of reminiscent of the older, like, the, you know, 70s punk bands where, you know, they came in, they did a couple great albums or releases, and then they just break up immediately, and then, you know, those shows and those records sort of become somewhat legendary, like, decades later? Is that kind of is that kind of the narrative we're seeing here?
I think, you know, when bands break up these days, they're like, we're all still friends, we all still like each other, you know, we just are choosing to move on to other projects because we've done what we've claimed to do. This seems more like a breakup to me.
Yeah.
You know, like, we hate each other, you know, and I think this is more of a genuine 70s breakup kind of thing. Uh-huh. And actually, Adam White, you know, you mentioned that you think it, like, was the previous statement disingenuous? I actually think it was. I think this whole thing went down probably like 2 days ago, 3 days ago, to tell you the truth. Because it was posted by Maximum Rock and Roll on, like, Sunday, which is, like, a weird time to post it, you know? And these kinds of bands where there's, like, they have, like, a super high ethics code, I guess, is just people can't, like, live up to the, you know, the super high code. I call it the Fugazi code. The problem is, you know, bands hold themselves to the Fugazi code, but it's just not doable because, remember, Fugazi was bringing in tens of thousands of dollars each month. You know, most bands are not bringing in tens of thousands of dollars each month. And so I think they were genuinely planning on doing something, and I think either there was probably something growing underneath, but none of them acknowledged it, or there was just a big blow up, and then they just decided to end the band because they all hate each other all of a sudden. And usually, when a band just completely implodes, it's usually because one of the main players is disagreeing with the rest of the players. You know, if it's the drummers, kick them out of the band. Who cares? You know what I mean? Sorry, drummers. But if it's, like, one of the main people, then maybe that's where the conflict comes from these sudden breakups. So, you know, I certainly don't know, but I think it's a sudden breakup, and I think their initial statement was genuine. But as with these, you know, what I call Fugazi bands, is they have such a high level that they hold themselves to that almost none of them can make it to, and they end up destroying, like, breaking apart rather than doing some kind of statement or message, despite that maybe they don't live quite up to the code they expect to live up to. So speaking of a band that did live up to its code, and the band that had a long lasting run, No Means No. They've broken up, but it was kind of weird because they haven't really done anything in, like, the last decade or so, or at least the last 5 or 6 years. But anyway, No Means No. So they're breaking up. John from No Means No said, "Greetings, everybody. John from No Means No here. With a heavy heart, I must announce the retirement of No Means No. A hiatus became a long hiatus, and a lingering hiatus has become a more permanent one. 35 years and countless miles, a couple of thousand shows, and many more beers, a bunch of tunes, and sweaty hordes of great fans, and I can't say thanks enough to everyone." He's going to continue his band, Compressorhead, which we interviewed John about, but Adam White, man, are you sad to see No Means No go? And I thought it was a little weird that they haven't done anything for the past, I don't know, 6 or 7 years, and now they're like, well, now we're breaking up. Like, why not just, you know, stay on the hiatus that they're on, you know?
That's kind of interesting. I mean, I guess the other thing that I'm curious about is that whether they're if they're just calling it a day, but you'll see, you know, their other projects crop up at the same in frequency that they did before. So, you know, are they going to go out and play some Hanson Brothers shows in you know, 3 years, and they would have done that kind of whether or not No Means No officially broke up this week or not. It's an odd breakup because they, yeah, again, they weren't really doing all that much. I like the, there's something about it where that I think is kind of better than an awkward hiatus, because No Means No is one of these bands that at some point 5 or 6 years ago, let's say, was, even if they weren't super active, was still maintaining a presence. So they had a website and a fan community, and you know, you could purchase their records, and stuff was in press, and stuff was in print, and whatever else, even if they weren't really doing much. But me, so I'm looking at my experience right now as someone that has like become sort of obsessed with this band over the past couple years, and they don't really have a lot of a lot of accessible stuff at the moment. Most of their records are out of print. Even their big records, their biggest record, 1989's Wrong. Like, good luck going into a record store and purchasing a copy of that at this point. They have some ancient, by internet terms, websites and things out there with, you know, incredibly out of date links to stores and incredibly out of date news and everything else. And it, I don't know, having a little bit of finality about what they're doing, to me, maybe feels a little bit better than just meandering. And I feel that, you know, given the way that bands are these days, especially bands that, you know, let's say amicably break up because they're old, you know, they'll probably be back in a few years doing something else. And that's just what seems to happen. You know, we ran a story a few years ago about SNFU breaking up, and it was a big story, and, you know, everyone was talking about, you know, Mr. Cheap Pig's mental problems and all the, everything that he's had to deal with, and how he's been, you know, such like a difficult and contentious frontman. So here you have this other, you know, famous Canadian punk band of that era calling it quits, but they fucking played a show in my town last Thursday. So, you know, you can never really know with any of these breakups of bands that have had long careers like this, whether anything's really going to stick all that much. Now, but hey, I mean, this absolutely made news in my circles. It made a lot of news. It was on the CBC. It was on, you know, all the Canadian music journalists that I saw were, you know, pouring out a beer for No Means No. So that was definitely made waves in ways that their, you know, inertia had not. Everyone was talking about them. So I have faith that they will at some point be back to do stuff, and I hope they do because they're amazing. But yeah, that's what's happening. So No Means No is officially broken up. And that probably isn't really any different from how anyone would have interacted with No Means No yesterday or last year.
Well, Adam, let's ride them off under the sunset with a nice tune. You got any good No Means No jams? Any recommendations that the fans should check out?
I mean, I want people's recommendations because I'm exploring this myself. I mean, I entered with the entry point that I think everyone should, which is the 1989 record Wrong, which is, in my opinion, like a super incredible, like desert islandish top 10 record. Wrong is incredible. And we're going to play a song from that in a second, because what better entry point than the amazing, incredible top of their whole career. But this band did so much stuff. And so much of the stuff that they did was weird or inaccessible or, you know, purposefully difficult, in a way that I think would appeal to a lot of people that were, say, fans of, I don't know, like Discord acts, fans of like the Minutemen, fans of a lot of like, you know, more challenging kind of like anarcho-punk stuff. They were all over the place. They were very,
Sorry if I can just interject real quick. I definitely got sort of a minor threadish feel from them.
No? Yeah, and depending on like the song, you know, you could get all sorts of stuff from No Means No. Their record one that came out, and I think what was it, 2004, I don't know when one came out, but like there is a like a 15-minute Miles Davis cover on that. Like there's all kinds of stuff within the depths of the No Means No universe. That's pretty crazy. A lot of people really like the collaboration record they did with Jello Biafra. So there's lots. I'm really curious. Write us, podcast@thepunknews.org. What's your personal No Means No jam? Because I want to check it out.
I love their humor. Like the name of that one record, All Roads Lead to Owl's Fart. Like, I just love that title.
Yeah, and or even just like they keep punning on their names all over the place. So John's last name is John Wright, and his brother in the band, of course, is also last name Wright. And all of their stuff is called wrong in some way. So it's just like goofy humor all over the place. But anyways, we're gonna play a song from Wrong, the 1989 record. The song is called Rags and Bones. It is, in my personal opinion, one of the best sounding punk rock songs ever from a recording standpoint. I don't know if that is going to come across to anyone in the compressed and regurgitated regurgitated audio, thank you, of the podcast format, but hey, go seek out the real thing and check it out. But just like to me, like the bass, of course, sounds amazing in this. The guitar sounds super alive. It's just so good to me. So this is Rags and Bones, by No Means No, off of 1989's Wrong. Rest in peace, band. Here you go.
Cigarette butt, why not?
And That Was No Means No, playing a song off wrong. It's wrong, but baby, it feels so right. Let's talk about one thing that feels right and one thing that feels wrong. Let's talk about Green Day and High on Fire. I know Adam White was comparing these two videos because they have a lot to do with each other. Two videos tearing up the blogosphere this week. Green Day, they released a video for their song Still Breathing off the upcoming album. It was basically a lyric video with some animation. And High on Fire released a video for their song Black Plot off last year's album. What is it called? Illumination. Their last...
Luminiferous.
Luminiferous. The song
Luminiferous.
Plot. And the video is... I'm just going to say it real quick, and then Adam White has got a lot to say about this. Man, you people need to check out the Black Plot video. It's basically like heavy metal, the movie or TV or comic book, or like Conan the Barbarian. It's far out, the video. Adam White, these two videos, where do you rank them in regards to each other?
Oh, God. All right. So, lyric video aside, and I mean, hey, fuck lyric videos, but lyric video aside, and Ricky, I want to hear your chime in on this, because I'll circle back to the actual video quality in a sec. This is a horrible song by Green Day. Like, wow, this is bad. This I was giving them a little bit of a pass with the with that Tim Armstrong produced video for what was it, Bang Bang, the first single that was here.
That was kind of a cool video.
The dumb house party.
Like, I was reaching when we talked about that. I was really trying to say that, you know what, I could maybe see how Green Day and a house party is you know, you squint and you tilt your head a little bit and it almost seems right, and I was trying to give them the benefit of the doubt. But this is bad. Ricky, why is this bad?
The Green Day one? Well, I mean, the video is, you know, it's a dumb lyric video, which, you know, standard dumb one, but this song, I mean, and you know, I know we the last what like two songs I've said are, you know, aren't good. This is garbage though. I mean, this is not there again. They have Billy Joe's voice with some kind of weird effect. There's no real aggression that we can get from Green Day sometimes at all. It's just very radio ready. I feel like I'll hear this, you know, being overplayed just on FM radio.
It is a pop song, but like in the worst sense of it being a pop song.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very forced pop song. The lyrics are boring and borderline stupid. A lot of similes, and it just got old really fast. Why their songs are pushing 4 minutes on this record is beyond me. A lot of them don't need to be this long. It's stupid. That's it. The High on Fire thing didn't, you know,
you like High on Fire? I'm not really, man.
Wait, whoa. Let's pull the reins on that, Johnny.
I love this video, Ricky. I love the High on Fire video.
The song didn't do a whole lot for me, but I definitely saw the heavy metal influence on it, and I definitely appreciated it. It was cool. It was. I also got kind of like a Metalocalypse sort of feel too, which I thought was which is cool. But watch that video instead of the Green Day one.
What it all said to me was that. So I watched that Green Day video, and I was just like, I felt tired. And then I felt angry, and then I felt tired, and I was just thinking, it's like partly just because I'm thinking, oh God, now I have to talk about this. Like now we have to go, hey, what's going on in the exciting world of punk rock? And we're like, Green Day released a vapid pop song, and then we have to talk about that. And that's disappointing. And then we were going to talk about all of these boring, is Green Day still punky kind of topics that everyone's talked about for like 20 years at this point, and then I watched that,
which in itself says
I know, and then I watched that High on Fire video, and I thought to myself, like, fuck, like metal people have so much more fun than punk people, like, oh my God, like I don't really care for metal in like a from like a musical standpoint, so like I can't be one of them. Like I was listening, if I would have closed my eyes and put on that song, it would have been like, this sounds like metal and I don't get it, but just watching this amazing, goofy, totally over the top, yeah, like definitely like in the style of the old heavy metal movie, you know, animation, about, I don't know, like a fucking like zombie space Viking, you know, slaughtering his enemies and then having like a back from the dead psychedelic freak out, and whatever, right? Like I'm watching it and I'm like, holy fuck, my whole life is a lie. This is the most amazing thing ever, right? like, where have I gone wrong that this music video and whatever is fueling it is not what I've based my whole life around, and instead I've got to talk about this dumb Green Day song. That's what I thought.
Yeah.
Here's the difference, is it seems to me that Green Day is trying to write to a certain... where they want to present them. First, the Green Day song sounds like a cell phone commercial song, but Green Day is trying to say, this is the band that we want to be, a youthful band that expresses, you know, a voice of hope and fear in the youth of today, and that's what we want to do, and this is what we want to be, whereas High on Fire is saying, this is what we are. We are a heavy metal band that tears shit up, that sings songs about Vikings getting their mind messed up by zombie women with giant breasts, and it's insane. And this is why High on Fire is just true to themselves, and why Green Day is struggling to find who they are.
Well, yeah, and isn't it kind of sad that at Green Day's stage of where they are in their careers, that they have to reinvent themselves yet again?
I don't think they're trying to reinvent themselves. I think they're trying to struggle to figure out who they are. And as Adam White,
yeah, okay, that's what I meant. But like, the fact that they have to do that again. Why?
I'm not even going to give them that much credit, because I don't think there's a reinvention with this particular Green Day track. They're not trying something that's like so stylistically out of the ballpark. It's just
true.
It's just if you heard this song not being performed by Green Day, but you heard it being performed by, I don't know what are the bands like Good Charlotte or something,
Coldplay.
That would be a reinvention.
If Maroon 5, I have a Maroon 5 story for you. I'm at the corner of two fairly major streets, as far as major streets go here in Niagara Falls. So there's a crosswalk. There's some people waiting to cross the crosswalk. There's a guy standing across from me, about to walk across the street. He is dressed like if you would have encountered this guy in, I don't know, like 1992, right? He would totally just be like some stoner metalhead looking guy. You know, big, I don't give a fuck about fashion shorts on, kind of wacky all over the place hair, you know, big black metal t-shirt, kind of like in the cardboard, that those old black cardboard t-shirts like you like, right?
Oh yeah, 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 yeah.
Yeah,
oh,
right.
You don't like, yeah, I love those t-shirts. The
cardboard. So exactly. Well, one of those. And then I'm like, what's this guy into? And I go and I kind of take a little look, and I'm expecting to see him with like, I don't know, what, like a fucking like Iron Maiden shirt on or something like that. And it says Maroon 5. And I'm like, huh. and I looked at him for a little while, and you know that moment where you look at someone and you're like, is this like an irony thing, or is it not an irony thing? Yeah, it's hard sometimes.
I had something similar happen, except it was a guy wearing a Goo Goo Dolls t-shirt, and I wasn't sure if he was serious or not.
I have a feeling that Goo Goo Dolls people are they live right on that bubble of irony and not irony, because I keep seeing it cross. Like sometimes you see people talking about a band online, and you know they're just doing it because it's just fucking hilarious to talk about that band. So yeah. Like, everyone talks about Smash Mouth all the time, just because like Smash Mouth are the Guy Fieri of music. So everyone laughs at it and just makes fun of it. And everyone's in on the joke that you can just talk about Smash Mouth all the time.
From San Jose, California.
And same with Hoobastank.
Yeah, right. Like the name there just says it all. So people talk about those bands. Clearly they're just fucking around. But Goo Goo Dolls is like given how much like even the punk scene these days is in love with all this 90s radio rock, really hard to say. Anyways, though, Maroon 5 guy crossing the street, they could have played this Green Day song. So here's what you should do. Don't go listen to this Green Day song, because you're going to hear it 6 million times over the next 12 years. But
yep.
Go watch this High on Fire video, because it'll melt your face.
What would happen if Green Day out with their new single and it was like a High on Fire song? What would people do then?
I want Green Day to release a sappy fucking love song like this, but then have the video be the High on Fire video.
Yes, yes.
That's what that, like, no one is, this is my problem. No one in Green Day is taking that chance. They have the world's attention. They could be just fucking with everyone all the time.
Mm.
And they're not. Mm. It drives me crazy.
Yeah, they're keeping it kind of close, like a little. They're being a little too cautious.
Now listen, people. Morrissey is showing cows getting their heads ripped off by machines, and Green Day singing like, "I want to hold my head above the rain." I'm just saying, people. Listen, speaking of sappy love songs, Cro-Mags. They recently played on September 17 down at Coney Island, New York. They played Warriors Festival, and I didn't even know this was a thing. Like, Adam and Rick, you guys know the movie Warriors. It's like this cheesy 80s film, The Warriors.
Yeah, yeah, that, it was made into a video game later on.
That's where the Baseball Furies came from. Before you get into this story, John, is that a normal thing that, like, you would make a music festival based on an old movie?
No, it's not normal. This is the first I've ever heard of anything like
that. Do you want to make a music festival based on, like Alien Resurrection? And we'll get, like, Ron Perlman and Winona Ryder to show up and...
No, we should do like Ladybugs, like that Rodney Dangerfield was in, or
no, Stranger Things Fest. We'll get everyone.
No, see, that's too hip. Hip.
How about Scrooge Fest with Bill Murray? Scrooge. We'll have David Johansen play. It's perfect. Anyways, so there was this festival where they celebrated the movie. I don't even think they watched the movie. I think they just had people from the movie there, and Cro-Mags and Murphy's Law and two other bands played. However, what happened was before the Cro-Mags went on, they said, okay, we got to get paid. Where's the money? The promoter, this guy named Eric Nienhaus, said, I don't have any money for you right now, but I'll pay you after the show. And the Cro-Mags said, okay, we'll play because the people want us to play, but you better pay us. And the next day, they went to get their money, and Eric Nienhaus faked a heart attack, was in the hospital, and said he didn't have the money, and the band is mad because it seems that all the bands didn't get paid any money, and it seems like a lot of the guys from the Warriors movie didn't get paid either. Interestingly, the festival had the exact same issues last year, but somehow still went off. Last year, they had funding issues and still went off. So, I mean, I don't know if there's a whole lot to say here. Except
did the guy fake a heart attack last year, too? He's like, not again.
Not again. Oh, no. Ricky, if there's one band that you kind of don't want to piss off, it might be the Cro-Mags. I'll say that. And
no, especially since, like, they beat the shit out of each other too.
If they stab each other, what do they think they'll do to you?
Don't do this to the Cro-Mags. I mean, do it to Justin Bieber or something. Don't do this to people that will, like, literally have a history of beating the
crap
out of each other.
What do you think happened? You think the guy just got in over his head? You think he's got other issues? How do you get yourself? Because, I mean, it's not like he threw, like what's a small band that, like, we care about that, like, nobody else cares about? Like, Gloss, maybe, for example. Well, that's a bad. How about Downtown Boys? You know, everybody likes Downtown Boys. Maybe Downtown Boys gets 500, maybe $1,000 a show, you know? If you screw it up, well, you screwed it up, you know. You didn't get $1,000 together, but Cro-Mags, that's probably, you know, $5,000-$10,000 for a show, you know. So how do you get in this situation?
You play sketchy festivals that are named after movies, after weird movies with sketchy drug addicted. It seems like, according to the article, promoters that have meth addicted girlfriends that try and. Cover
and
for them.
What's the goal here? What's the promoter's goal? And we don't know what happened. This is all alleged.
Keep the money for himself to spend on drugs that he's addicted to.
And what do you think of the band making this a public thing?
Oh, I think to show that they're getting ripped off, and two, also to hopefully make sure that other bands don't do. Business.
Yeah, I'm totally cool with bands making it public when a promoter's ripped them off or something like that. Like,
yeah,
and also, as long as it's not like just, you know, a he said, she said in contention kind of thing. If, like, a bunch of people were clearly screwed by someone, hey, by all means, like, let them know.
Yeah, and if, I mean, as long as they're not, like, as long as they have the proof and they're not libeling anyone, I mean, go for it.
The one thing that I'd really like to know is that if you, and forgive me, I'm going to make a broad generalization about the healthcare in the U.S. here. If you fake a heart attack and then have to go to the hospital, the doctor or whoever is still going to charge you, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so if you're like, I don't want to pay Cro-Mag $6,000, and then you fake a heart attack and you go to the hospital, and then they're like, okay, now you own the hospital $6,000.
Yeah, but if you don't pay the hospital, the worst they'll do is sue you. If you don't pay the Cro-Mags, yeah. Maybe something a lot worse will happen, you know?
Also, if you go to the, I think if you go to the, if you go to the emergency room and they don't, and they give you just the, they, I think what they do is they give you like the bare minimum of what you need, and then they charge you, and then, the, and then after that, it'll probably just go to collection agencies until they sue you. So it's basically you're just putting it off, I think.
That's wow, America sucks. Sorry.
But I think that's how it goes. Yeah, don't. This also seems like a small festival. Why would they consider doing this? I mean, unless I'm wrong.
Well, hey, I mean, I think like if you're Cro-Mags and someone comes to you and, you know, outside of any of the sketchiness, they say, we're putting together this wacky punk rock festival dedicated to the movie The Warriors. That would that seems like it would be totally up your alley. in the abstract, that seems kind of awesome. So... I could see why you would want to be a part of this ridiculous thing. I can get that for sure. But, yeah.
Lesson learned. Don't do festivals that are named after movies.
So, John, let's move on here.
Yeah.
Rolling Stone. You want me to read? You want to comment? What do you think?
Why don't you read? I got a little bit to say about this.
So Rolling Stone, the magazine, the much storied, you know, much
heralded.
Was at one point very, very important for, you know, for rock bands to find coverage in, has developed into like a sort of a multifaceted modern magazine that is actually sort of really well known for their investigative journalism at this point. But anyways, Rolling Stone, everyone knows what it is. I don't know why I'm trying to explain it, has been sold. So Jan Werner, the founder and owner of Rolling Stone.
Jan Werner.
Okay, I don't know anything. Has sold a 49% stake, so a non-controlling share, I guess, of Rolling Stone to BandLab Technologies. That company is a new company which was formed in Singapore. It is owned by... Oh, why do I got to read these names? is formed by a guy who is the son of another guy who is one of the richest people in the world. By all means, go to punknews.org and butcher their names yourself. I'm trying not to be a horrible person and do that. So it appears that Werner has just sold this stake. He hasn't actually sold the any stake of the parent company that he owns, just of Rolling Stone the magazine. And so according to both companies' press releases, BandLab is going to have no editorial control over what goes on with Rolling Stone in the States, but they will launch and oversee a new international subsidiary of Rolling Stone, the details of which really aren't available yet. So a bit of business news there regarding one of the most famous rock and roll magazines in the world. John, any thoughts here? You want to...
Yeah, I got a lot of thoughts. I know a lot of the punk rockers are too cool for Rolling Stone, but man, I think Rolling Stone is the greatest. They got the greatest interviews, some of the greatest, if not the greatest interviews, great reviews, very good investigative reporting. I know they had a whole thing with that whole rape on campus thing, but I mean, that was a bummer. But, you know, I mean, if you consider their legacy as a whole, I think they're fantastic.
Rolling Stone did so much good work, like, during the latest war in Iraq. Like, they had a lot of stuff that was out regarding that I think was a big deal.
I actually have a lot to talk about for that rape on campus article. We won't talk about that now, but maybe we'll talk about it sometime on down the road. There's a lot of interesting things to talk about there. I think Rolling Stone's fantastic. I think it's still great. It's a little thinner than it used to be, which is kind of a bummer, but the fact is nobody's buying magazines anymore. This news did bum me out. What I did like about Rolling Stone is, unlike most magazines, Rolling Stone was owned by a guy, Jan Werner. And he actually was semi-active in like basically everything in the magazine went up to him eventually, in that like if something's in the magazine, it's because Jan Werner wants it to be there. Not like he edited every article or even like you know, looked over every article, but he was the guy and he was active in the magazine, and he still is active in the magazine. His son's taking over next year. So it's kind of a bummer to me that it's no longer his magazine. Now it's his and a company's magazine, and the company's not even really known for music. They sell guitars in, you know, East Asia. So that bums me out. Really, to some degree, what it is, it's a licensing deal, and that basically he's licensing the name for this company to make a Asian version of Rolling Stone magazine, or maybe a worldwide version of Rolling Stone magazine. And I wonder if it'll be like the American Rolling Stone magazine. There already is Italian Rolling Stone. There's Australian Rolling Stone. There's UK Rolling Stone, some other Rolling Stones, but I guess they're going to make more of them or consolidate them or something. So I understand if this is what he has to do to save the magazine. I understand that because magazines aren't selling, even though Rolling Stone is great. But I am sad in that Rolling Stone is no longer purely Jan Werner's creation and ownership. Even though I certainly didn't agree with all the reviews and everything in the magazine. I liked how it was, this guy is the guy making all the final shots at the end of the day. And this is the baby that he has control over. And now it's kind of like a lot of, here's what I'm saying is, I enjoyed the fact that it was created by his vision, and you could see everything in the magazine sprang from him. So you could say, this is why they're doing that. This is why they're doing this. Now that a corporation owns it, it's like, well, are they doing this because they're trying to, you know, raise money? Are they doing this because someone has an ownership stake? You know, it makes it a lot more ambiguous and a lot less pure to me. And so I still love Rolling Stone magazine. I always will, but this does bum me out a little bit.
Was it just hemorrhaging money or something? I mean, that's a huge 49%. I mean, that's as much as you can go. Were they just losing a ton of money and this was just their only out? Or is there like you said, like an actual plan to do this? And will the quality stay the same?
Well, I guess is according to this, the U.S. version should be unaffected entirely. And it's, to me, it does sound more like a licensing deal. And I really wish he just licensed it and didn't sell ownership, but. You know, listen, I haven't seen the book, so maybe it was necessary. I don't know.
So I don't really have much more to say about that, but they, you know, Rolling Stone, it'll be curious to see if anything trickles back to what they are as far as the U.S. goes. Before we wrap up with a song, Ricky, you did something really cool with Off With Their Heads. Why don't you chat about that?
Oh yeah. So we premiered, I think it was yesterday. We premiered, Clear the Air, the acoustic version that Ryan Young and Off With Their Heads have been working on. And if you've been keeping up with the Anxious and Angry podcast, you'd hear like him, you know, kind of telling everyone how it's been going. And so, the PR people reached out to me and said, hey, we want to do an interview and premiere the first song. And I said, yeah, let's do it. And I was pleasantly surprised. It's not just the same song on acoustic guitars. It's actually it's quite good. They added some piano in there. There's a lot, you know, that the vocals are a little different, especially when it comes to the emotion. But still, it was really good. I don't know if you guys had it, and also it was always great to talk to Ryan again. This was the second time I've interviewed him this year. And he always has cool things to say. So yeah, check out the interview, check out the song. I believe that record is coming out on October 25th. The first pressing of 200 copies on through Epitaph have already sold out. So this clearly is a highly anticipated album. And it's just kind of like the album scored, you can see the track listing, but it has a bunch of, they picked and chose different songs from different Off With Their Heads albums to play acoustically. And they're going to be going on tour later this year, I think, like the Northeast and the Southeast of the U.S. Check both of those out. The song's great. And look out for probably more songs that are going to be premiered later on other websites or whatever. So I don't know. Did you guys get a chance to listen to it at all?
Not before it vanished.
Oh, yeah. I don't know why that happened. For some reason, it went back to private, which shouldn't have happened. But anyway, look out for it. John, were you able to listen to it
before it went away? I was about to click on it and it said, vanished. Screw you.
Well, even you can even see in the comments, almost, I don't think anyone gave it, no one seemed to give a shit, and people on Facebook were very excited for it. So yeah, keep an eye out for it. I think the digital version will be out on their Bandcamp. But yeah, that was definitely a bigger premiere that we've done lately. So I was excited.
Yeah, and everyone should go check it out whenever it is more available to listen to, because, Off of Their Heads is cool. So
they are.
There you go. I guess let's play one more song and then we will wrap this sucker up. So Ricky, do a thing.
Yeah, so I was told by a friend over Twitter, Tommy from Natters, who I played, a band I played of I guess a few weeks ago. He's like, you should check this band out. They're called Jaded Eyes. And they're cool. They kind of have they're a hardcore band out of the UK. I thought they had sort of a fucked up vibe, believe it or not. And they released an album called Gods and Monsters on Boss Tunage Records in 2013, and I thought I'd play a song by them. The song is called Control. It's the first track off that album. Again, they're called Jaded Eyes out of the UK, and here is Control.
Tricky Ricky bringing you the jams from Jaded Eyes. Listen, this episode, I don't know if this episode could have been any more sexier than it was. You know, we're talking about cows getting killed, international business deals, talking about people ripping off the Cro-Mags. It's not as sexy as it gets. Tricky Ricky, on a scale of 1 to 69, how sexy are you feeling after we engaged in all the sexy sex talk?
Oh, 68.
68, not bad. Adam White, how sexy are you feeling on a scale of 1 to 69?
I've just been mainlining a pot of tea this whole episode, and it's making me feel like logy and weird now. So, like a 4.
Yeah, there you go. Well, listen, people, all your sex advice, running the podcast at punknews.org, and we will see you, all you sexy listeners, next week.